Hey, welcome back to Trailblaze. I'm Jamal Simmons. I'm here with Matt Butler, and we are talking to a really good friend who has joined us, Andre Cherney. Andre Cherney, are you there?
He's here.
Good to see you guys.
Matt, you've known Andre for a long time. We've both known Andre for a long time. You know, he has run for office. He's been a speechwriter to the vice president. He runs major organizations, and now he's working on another big project. And Matt, I think you've been paying some attention to it, right?
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about Project 2029, but in a little bit. But let's go back. I mean, Andre, I think when I met you, you were spending hours and hours and hours writing John Kerry's announcement speech for our South Carolina event, which probably would have been, I don't know, what, like March or April of 2023?
September.
September. It was September 2023.
Yes, right after. Yeah, September 2023.
Yeah. And then the surprise was you spent all this time working on this speech, and it turned out that there was someone else working on an announcement speech at the same time, unbeknownst to you and to the campaign manager and a lot of the staff. And then we sort of found out that there was sort of a shadow organization on a lot of levels. There was another pollster who was doing some work. There was another potentially media company that wanted to do some work. And it was sort of these long-time Kerry Boston folks who sort of like ended up kind of being layered on, and Bob Schrum layered on top. So tell us what do you remember about that, and kind of like when
Democrats.
You found out that there was another potential speech that was going to be given at the announcement.
The endless cluster of a presidential campaign, which is always just complete chaos. And you know, understandably, right, you have these huge organizations being built while you're flying the plane, and a bunch of people running around trying to figure out how to especially get a nomination with many candidates. We can talk about what this time around looks like. But there was warring speech drafts and warring consultants and point of view. And in some ways, 2004 campaign is a long, long time ago. But I think it has some interesting lessons for this time around. It was probably the most, this 2028 campaign is probably the most wide open presidential field since 2004, maybe even since 1992. And you had some established candidate, you had Howard Dean coming out of nowhere. And so really I think the different speech drafts were all different attempts to figure out how do you find a lane to get to the nomination in a crowded field.
Yeah, it was. I do remember. I feel like every time I talk to somebody who worked for that Howard Dean campaign, I'm like, oh yeah, I had a pretty bad ulcer because of you guys, because you were a thorn in our side for a good solid 6 months. We started out, everybody expected us to win the nomination, and then we kind of cratered, and then ended up coming back. But it was that was a tough 2003. But it was. I'm glad we got to go through it. Wish the end would have been different, but that was a really fun time, and I learned a ton. And I think you're right. I think there is a lot to be learned for the 2028 cycle, which we can come back to.
Well, and Jamal and I knew each other on the 2000 campaign, which was another complete mess.
We've been at this for a long time. I think, you think about these big swaths of interest in the Democratic Party that have always been around, right? So whether you go back to like the 80s, where there's the Jesse Jackson movement versus, you know, Mondale, or then or Dukakis, in 1992 there was kind of the Tom Harkin or some of the more liberal folks who were versus Bill Clinton, and then you keep going forward. Howard Dean was a watershed moment. I think Howard Dean was, in our generation, the crystallization of some really progressive politics. And then, frankly, you get to 2008, where Barack Obama was kind of this hybrid, where he was of the progressive movement, but kind of seen as a sensible progressive. I know young people today will kind of look at Barack Obama and they say, progressive? Barack Obama's not progressive. But in 2008, Barack Obama was considered to be the more progressive candidate versus Hillary Clinton. I mean, am I getting that wrong?
No, was running on his anti-Iraq war credentials and absolutely.
Yeah. So, and then obviously now, the Bernie movement has taken all of that and put it on steroids because it probably got the closest, maybe since Jackson in 88, it probably got the closest of any progressive candidate, pure progressive without kind of, more moderate sheen. It got the closest of any of those to actually capturing the nomination. I mean, in 2016 and then 2020, Bernie Sanders was really a couple of good primary caucus elections away from being a Democratic nominee for president.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it definitely is a way to track just what's happened in the party and what's going to be happening.
Yeah, so we've got this big, we'll talk about this some more. We've got these big debates, right, between kind of the more progressive lane, the more centrist, for lack of a better word, or the one that's more mainstream lane. But the question I think a lot of people would ask today is the mainstream moving? Is the mainstream moving left? And I'd love to get, your sense about that.
I often think that those categories don't necessarily hold a lot of weight. And I think in my mind, a lot of those debates are more around rhetoric and positioning. Should we be less woke on one side? Should we go after billionaires with more force rhetorically, as opposed to policy-wise? I know we'll talk about Project 2029, but part of the work there has been really bringing together people from across the liberal, progressive, democratic party spectrum. What we find is, yeah, there's interesting conversations and debates, but there's not super clear lines. You see this going on right now, the abundance movement of saying, okay, we need to look at some of the red tape that's holding back building housing and so on. A guy like Mayor Mamdani, who supposedly is on a very different rhetorical side of the Democratic Party, is looking at a lot of those types of solutions as well. So you look at a Mayor Mamdani and a Mikey Sherrill in New Jersey, you would say they're very, very different in terms of wings of the Democratic Party. But you look at what they're talking about, affordability, how to bring down electric rates, how to help kids get childcare. It's not, I think there's more smoke there than there is fire.
That's interesting. So why don't you tell us about Project 2029, kind of what it is and kind of where you guys are with the project so far?
Yeah. So look, it really began with an acknowledgement that in the 2004 campaign, 2024 campaign, we're talking about 2024 campaign.
I know, we got to get out of our time warp. Right. Okay, we're all moving forward. 2024, 2028. That's what this is about.
Skip ahead. Look, there was a lot that went right, a lot that went wrong, but on election day, just about everybody in America could tell you what the Republicans and what Donald Trump were going to do if elected. And we'll talk about Matt's screed on our name in a previous podcast, and we'll get into that. But
it's just suggestions. They're just suggestions.
Yeah, I love the conversation. but look, that entire campaign, the way I look at it, the Republicans said, here's what we're going to be doing. And the Democrats spent all of their time saying, here's what the Republicans are going to be doing.
Yeah.
And while everybody knew what the Republicans were going to do, there probably weren't five people in America who could tell you how their lives would be better and different if Democrats won. And we've seen this over and over again. You can't beat something with nothing. If you don't define yourself, somebody else will. And so that's just on a basic political level. But the reality is, too, that from on a policy level, if our economy was working well, if our democracy was working well, if our social structures, our education system was working well, Donald Trump and those folks would not get within spitting distance of the White House. And people in America, in most parts of America, have been economically stagnant. And for most people, they feel the ladder of upward mobility has broken down. They no longer feel the American dream is anything but rhetoric. They don't see it in their lives and in their children's lives. And if we don't have a positive vision that actually is big enough and bold enough to resonate with that, to speak to that, then it's easy for somebody to come along with a message not of hope, but of hate, and of saying, look, I may or may not have any answers for you, but I'll tell you who to blame for your troubles. And it's those people with, you know, different color skin or come from a different country or go to a different bathroom or whatever else it might be. And we let our politics become around that. And so you have to actually have policies and ideas that are big enough for the moment. And lastly, I'll just say, like, even if none of that was true, what the current administration is doing is breaking apart so much of the infrastructure of government of the last century. You're not going to go back and say, let's rebuild the Department of Education as it was in 1977. Let's go rebuild USAID or CFPB or any of these institutions. If there's any small silver lining, there's a chance to build anew and to say, what does progressive government look like in the 21st century? And how do we deal with issues like AI and issues like climate change and all of these other big challenges that this is a moment to hopefully confront in real ways? And so that's what we're, that's the idea of what we're doing. What we've been working on is bringing together literally hundreds of the top experts on, you name the issue, whether it's housing or healthcare or national security, people who have experience in the past three Democratic administrations, but a lot of other new voices as well, people from who are in academia or think tanks or professors or private sector, and really hunting for the best big new ideas and going to start rolling them out over the next year and culminating in a Project 2029 volume. There'll be 30 to 50 big ideas really as the primary process gets going. People can follow what we're doing at Project2029forAmerica.org. And we're going to be starting to roll out those ideas in the next few weeks and then continuing to do so.
So Andre, listen, you are joining us. You are running the 2029 effort. And tell us who else is involved. You gave us some categories, but are there any people that we should be paying attention to from any particular states? Or, you know, how are you thinking about this from some of the Democratic, you know, base or interest groups? Who's doing this?
So I'm not running it day to day. I'm chairing the effort. And we have a great executive director named Chad Mizell, who's driving this and a team of folks that are working on it. But we've been really reaching out broadly, talking to folks at many of the different think tanks. I think that maybe gives a sense of the breadth. So people from the Roosevelt Institute and Groundworks Collaborative on what maybe more of what it would be described as the left, people from Center for American Progress, New America, people from the Third Way organization and Progressive Policy Institute on maybe more the centrist side of things. And again, you know, it's not just think tanks, but it is people with deep experience in past administration. You know, some of the names have been public, but really it's built into working groups that are about 300 people currently who are really doing the day-to-day work on these different issue areas.
And just to the working groups sort of, you know, mimic the kind of the working groups that you would see on a transition once you have a nominee. I mean, I know doing Kerry transition stuff and then Clinton transition stuff in 2016, you know, most of that stuff happened behind the scenes, right? It was, you know, from August after the convention until the election, you were getting ready with books and, you know, a lot of it was also personnel, but it was behind the scenes. This is, you know, obviously starting much earlier and being much more public. Is that, I assume that's intentional.
Absolutely. Look, I'd say it's a little bit like that, but it's also a little bit like what you would see on a presidential campaign, where you have policy teams working on different issue areas. And really, as we think about what we're doing, there's different concentric circles of the audience that we're speaking to. But part of it is to those presidential candidates and their teams, giving them some ideas that they can take off the shelf and run on. You know, in a past life, I was editor and co-founder of Democracy Journal. And when we started that in 2005, one of the first people we worked with was then law professor Elizabeth Warren, who had an idea that she came to us with for what she was thinking of calling the Financial Product Safety Commission. And so we ran that idea and published it for the first time and put together a PR strategy around that and got her on CNN. I remember how excited she was to get to be able to get on CNN back then.
That's fantastic.
And then we shopped it to the different presidential candidates. And, you know, we were talking about some of these past campaigns. We shopped it to Hillary Clinton's campaign, and they said, no, we don't want a new bureaucracy like this. We shopped it to Barack Obama's campaign. He said, no. John Edwards was the only person who ran on that idea in 2007, 2008. And then when then-Senator Obama became the nominee, he adopted it and put it into his platform and his policy plan. And then it became the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau after the Dodd-Frank bill. So that's a little bit of the model that we're going with here. Let's put out some big, bold ideas. Let's put out some big swings. And then
That's great. So you're saying you got, you want to put out some big, bold ideas. What are a couple of the big, bold ideas that you're willing to talk about? What can you say right now that people should be thinking about getting ready for this 2029 launch?
So, like I said, we're working on the entire landscape of ideas, and there's a lot more coming. We've previewed some of them, but I'll just say this with a caveat that just because we're talking about this issue doesn't mean we're not working on issues A, B, C, D, E, and F, and those are still coming. But, you know, one idea that I'm excited about is ending the monopoly on the electric grid. Again, we're talking about affordability. We're talking about people's electric bills rising and rising, and that's been such a sore subject for a lot of people. Talking about job creation, talking about how to fight climate change. And part of the problem is that the electric utilities in most parts of the country are a monopoly. They're regulated by public service commissions in different states, often commissions that they, where they end up electing who's the actual commissioners. They get to set the rates. They don't have any competition. And so here's an idea to break apart that monopoly, introduce some competition into it so that anybody coming along with a better alternative, a less expensive alternative, a cleaner alternative can plug directly into the grid and bring their service directly to folks. So that's one. Another that we're excited about.
Can we stay on that one for 1 second? Sure. So what's the goal here? Is the goal to lower costs? Is it the goal for clean energy? Is the goal to break up big economic powerhouses of the utility companies? What's the goal of that policy?
Yes. Yes to all of the above.
Yes.
And job creation. All of those things. This is a, you know, kind of a Swiss Army knife kind of idea, because it does a lot of things. And it's something specific that people can actually say, okay, this is, can actually get implemented. This is, you know, again, going back to a little bit of history, it's what happened with the telephone industry, with the Telecommunications Act of 1996, where back then you had the different baby bells, as they were called then, after Ma Bell broke up. And that act said, all right, we're going to open up the system to competition, and whoever comes along with a better alternative can engage. And we saw an explosion of options and lower costs for people. So this is something that does a lot of those things all at once. We know the future economy is going to need more electricity, more options, especially with the way that industry is going. It's a way to fight climate change that is not just about let's limit people's ability to do different things, but about let's create jobs and build the economy of the future and inject some real competition into the space.
Now, Andre, that sounds like a proposal that a lot of different candidates could get behind. But, you know, what about when we get to sort of the bigger issues that are a little more controversial? So, like, let's take like universal health care or Medicare for all. You know, you've got a couple of candidates who are way out there and believe that this is what we need to do. I'd say a lot of the energy in the Democratic Party is for something like that. But the majority of the candidates so far have not been able to get onto that train. And so how are you guys going to kind of deal with issues like that where there really is big division? And kind of how do you figure out what the proposal is going to be whoever the candidate is to pick up?
Look, our job here is not to get consensus. This is not the Democratic Party platform. I've done that job before in the past. I don't need to do that one again. What is the value add that we can offer is some new thinking and some new ideas. And so, you know, Medicare for All has been out there, and there's people who are going to be running on it, and there's pluses and minuses for that, and people who are going to be for it and against it. We're going to be, of course, rolling out ideas around healthcare. I think our mission is, okay, what can we offer that is new, maybe a different angle on some of these things? And so I don't want to prejudge it because we're looking at a lot of different alternatives, but I think one thing I would say just generally, and this doesn't necessarily link to what we're going to end up doing at Project 2029, is there has been a lot of energy, and there should be a lot of energy over the past century, really, around coverage of people. And we have taken some big steps forward, whether it was Medicare, whether it was Obamacare, ACA. And there's still more work to do. There's still people who are not covered right now. But we also need to be looking at the 85, 90% of people who are covered by healthcare today and facing enormous costs that are out of line with really any other developed country in the world. And we need to be speaking to those folks as well. And so I think that's one area where I think there's some work to do of saying, okay, what are we speaking to those people who are self-insured and dealing with those kinds of costs, businesses who are facing that, families with high deductibles. How do we speak to that? That is a way to address some of those issues as well. So I think that's the kind of thing that hopefully we can be injecting some new ideas into this debate and into the bloodstream.
So Andre, before we move to the end of the segment, here's the thing that's really gnawing on me, and I want to know what your take is on this. It seems to me that a big reason why we are in this predicament, you talked about the ways the government hasn't been working, is that people feel like the growth trajectory of the country is declining. Their opportunity to participate in that growth is evaporating. You know, this sort of American dream concept is slipping through their fingers like sand at the beach. And nobody really has an idea about how to change that. And it seems very often, at least Trump, you know, sort of Trump talks a big game about growing the economy, but the Democrats seem like they're trying to make poverty and distress less onerous, right? Yeah. And so it's like our agenda is we're going to make the bad parts less bad for you as we navigate this. So I'm just wondering, as you guys are writing this, how much of that is driving you, like a pro-growth agenda that people can sort of latch into? And so when we start talking about including more people in the economic enterprise, we're not talking about taking things away from people. We're talking about how do we add things to everybody else's plate?
Yeah, 100% agree with that. You look at the numbers, the growth rate of the economy over this past quarter century, Democratic administrations and Republican administrations alike, has never gotten to the levels that we saw in the 1980s and 90s, and for much of the 20th century. We saw 4% annual growth. You know, we're lucky if we're seeing 2% in a lot of the years. You know, other than the one year where we were coming out of COVID, and that was an artificial bump because we were so low. But generally, we've been well under that. You know, that sounds like, okay, what's the difference between 4% and 2%, 3%? It makes a massive difference in people's lives. And, you know, one of the things that is driving what we're doing is the understanding that there's been a lot of these debates over the years, and there's an answer to this that is not just growth will take care of everything. A rising tide will lift all boats, because there's a lot of boats that don't get lifted, even in strong growth. And at the same time, part of how you get to strong growth is by actually investing in people and untapping the resources that we have of human capital, the people who are getting left behind, who could be the next great startup founders or contributing to the economy in much bigger ways. And, you know, with AI, that's going to become even more and more important because it's going to be taking away some of those entry-level jobs, not just blue-collar jobs, but white-collar entry-level jobs as well. And so that investment in people is going to become more important. So there's an answer here around growth that is looking at the industries of the future and how we power them, both literally and metaphorically, how we drive that kind of growth in terms of building the infrastructure of America, whether it's physical infrastructure, human infrastructure, and so on. And you can do all of those things and still make sure that you're building that ladder of opportunity. And that's part of why I think we talk about in terms of opportunity as opposed to necessarily just looking at inequality or things like that, because we don't see the static world. Part of what I think it being an American is about is this idea that if I apply myself, I can do better. I believe that my kids will do better than I will. That's been true in just about every generation of Americans up to now. And that's not just a public opinion view. That is actually the reality of most people's lives, that their kids aren't doing better. And that's one of the things we have to reverse, because that is how growth gets translated into the individual level.
All right. Andre Cherney, thank you for joining us. We look forward to seeing more from Project 2029 and see what kind of big ideas you guys have coming.
Yeah, hope folks will visit us and join us and become part of this conversation.
And what's the website again?
Project2029forAmerica.org.
So Matt, you know, there's a lot going on right now. Obviously, people are consumed by what's happening in Maine. I think right now, today, I'm particularly consumed about what happened in Madison Square Garden during the Knicks game, which we have not talked about, how Trump jinxed the Knicks.
Yeah, well, I mean, bad stuff happens when he enters the building. So, I mean, I think, didn't he come to one of the Washington Nationals World Series games at home? And I think they lost at home when he was there, because they lost all three games at home in that series. So, you know, look, I mean, James Dolan, you know, you get what you asked for. You invited him and that's what you got. So,
Lord, I mean, people said that it was horrible trying to get into Madison Square Garden. 2 hours early, you had to arrive to go through the magnetometers. You know, they put him up on the screen, and as they call it, the Bronx cheer, right? Yeah. The boos were deafening.
65% of the audience booing.
Yes, exactly. And then the big nap.
you're knocked out. Yeah, you're sitting in a $25,000 seat and you're asleep. So, you know, I don't know. He is the most unpopular president in history. He's not doing anything to help himself. I mean, it really is. It's shock, and I guess it's not shocking, but it's interesting.
Nothing at all. Okay, so that Trump at the Knicks, kind of, it seems like maybe competing with the Graham Plattner story in Maine, but you think maybe both of those stories are competing with a third story that nobody's talking about anymore.
Well, I don't think they're competing with the story. I think they've completely they've completely subsumed it. And I would say that
this is a fight they won.
No, look, the biggest beneficiary from the Graham Plattner mess up in Maine is Ken Martin. I mean, 2 weeks ago, all we were talking about was the DNC autopsy and what should happen to Ken Martin, and can he go on, and can people actually listen to him and trust the DNC? And nobody's mentioned Ken Martin's name in at least 7 or 8 days. I mean, this has been incredibly good for Ken. So he's probably going to be able to slide through this and keep going. And look, you know, the autopsy was a mess, but you know, I've still been supportive of him and his efforts to build up state parties and get ready for these elections. So maybe it's fine. But anyway, he's got to be pretty happy this week.
You know, I mean, the one thing about politics is you never know what's coming around the corner. I mean, that's one of the tricks, right? Any of these campaigns, if you can just hold on long enough, the weather may change and then you could be in a completely different sea. So
I will also note, nobody blamed the Graham Plattner situation on Ken Martin, right?
Like that's true.
You know, everybody was taking shots from that, but nobody blamed Ken Martin. So, you know, good week for Ken.
Yeah, good week for Ken. Maybe also a good week for Susan Collins. But we will see. We will see how she turns out, you know, after this primary and as we go further. It may also be that people in Maine really just don't care because they, as I heard one woman say, she'd vote for like a hammer or something over voting for Susan Collins because she's so far in the bed with Donald Trump on all these policies and voting for all the things that he's doing. They just want to get rid of Collins, at least to send a message to Trump. So, Plattner may benefit from that still, despite his personal problems.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see what percentage of the vote he gets tonight. I mean, he's almost certainly going to win. And, you know, is that win going to be 55% or is that going to be closer to 70% of the vote? So I think, we're going to know a lot more tomorrow.
If I was in Maine, I would tell you, I would vote for Janet Mills just to send the message that there is a constituency out there that he has to pay attention to. That's not just a bunch of Graham Plattner sycophants and acolytes. That he needs to pay attention to this sort of Mills constituency because that might pull him to keep him from going maybe too far off the rails in one direction or another. But he's got to have some competition, I think, in the Democratic Party, so that he can be appealing, I think, to Mainers on the other side. I mean, he knows his politics better, but I would do it just to send a message. And then obviously I'd vote for him in the general, unless I find out something else that I just can't live with.
Yeah, I mean, look, I am on the Plattner side of things because I actually like that he's not listening to sort of the Janet Mills Democrats. I mean, I think we need a lot more of that right now. When we had Andre Turney on, he talked about bold ideas. I mean, Graham Plattner's talking about bold ideas. He's talking about big fixes for wrong with this economy and this country, and we need more of that. I think Plattner's issue is not kind of where he is ideologically right now. It is there anything else in the closet that's going to come out? And he really can't afford to have anything else come out. Like, let's get back to talking about the economy and helping working people. And that's where he's going to be doing his best.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, talking about the economy, working people and how things are changing. I saw a story that I sent you earlier that I thought was interesting. It was talking about the shift from in the Democratic Party between the makeup of people who are more centrist and moderates and people who are more liberal and progressive and how that shift has really occurred. I'll just give you a couple of numbers that we could talk about. The first one is right now, 66% of Democrats have a positive view of socialism. That's a big number. 66% have a positive view of socialism. Only 38% of independents and like 14% of Republicans. The second number is on economic issues, 61% call themselves liberal on economic issues. 61% of Democrats say they're liberal on economic issues. In the 1990s, 25% of Democrats identified as liberal or very liberal, is according to Gallup. And in 2026, 61% of Democrats consider themselves liberal or very liberal. The question I have is two questions. One, does that mean that people have left the Democratic Party and become independent, so there are more liberals left? Or have people who were Democrats migrated more to the left than the center where maybe we thought they were 25 years ago, 30 years ago?
My guess is it's the latter. When we grew up sort of as we're, you know, in our kind of 20s in politics, you know, in the early 90s, we're coming out of basically 20, 25 years of the right really taking the word liberal and absolutely making it toxic. And, you know, it was the politics were a little bit different in the late 60s going into the 70s. And so, you know, people ran from the word liberal and Democrats were terrible on foreign policy and we were weak and the Soviet Union was going to basically be on our doorstep if you were elected a Democrat. And so we lost three big presidential elections right in a row. And it wasn't until until Clinton came along in 92. And you still didn't want to be liberal, right? You might have been, maybe you could be progressive, but that was third way, and the New Democrats and sort of moderate was exactly where you wanted to be. But things have changed in the last 30 years. I mean, I do think that people have gotten to be a lot more open-minded about kind of how the economy works for people, how it works for working people, kind of who's getting screwed over. I also think that in the 80s and 90s, the wealth gap was not anywhere near the size that it is now. And so people are understanding that this economy is not working for the vast majority of people and things have to change. And so if that is turning people liberal, that's where people are. And so, no, I think the Democratic Party is getting more liberal. I mean, I will say even just for myself, like I have been one of these sort of Clinton centrist Democrats. That's kind of how I came up. And as I've told you, like I'm pretty DSA curious these days. Like I do think there are huge problems in this country, and we need to be able to figure out new solutions to deal with them. And this sort of status quo and 50% plus one kind of moderation and kind of the Democratic Party as it was in the 90s, I don't think is the right solution for what we're facing. And we're going to have to be more progressive, more liberal.
I think you nailed something that it's a hard conversation maybe for people who are more liberal to give credit here, but I do think this is real. It's almost like the Democrats are benefiting from earlier successes, or some would say the centrists are being hit for earlier successes. Bill Clinton made it safe to be a Democrat and run for president again. I know that's hard for people to remember, but as you just laid out, Democrats, not only if we lost three elections in a row, except for Jimmy Carter, we had lost the two elections before that.
Right.
So there's only been one Democrat elected president since 1964, by the time Bill Clinton ran in 1992. So Bill Clinton made it safe for Democrats to be president again. Then his economic policies had a lot of growth. People liked it. They didn't like his personal behavior. Al Gore got punished for that in 2000. Then you get Barack Obama, who's really more progressive, but he's got a lot of economic policy maybe that comes from Clinton. And people don't really like that. And so there's a blowback against Obama. You can really trace it back to the way he didn't go after bankers after the 2008, 2009 financial collapse. And he didn't really go after Wall Street. And I think people said, no. We want some justice here. We're not for this kind of Wall Street economics anymore. And so now I think people are much more comfortable speaking up about it. And also the stakes are lower. People will vote for Democrats. We know that people will vote for Democrats. So you don't have to kind of pretend to be a Republican or have a Republican light policy in order to get elected.
Yeah. And I also think we're seeing people move like to the extremes. I mean, that's sort of the social media, social media kind of universe that we're living in. Like the extremes get amplified. That's what gets rewarded. That's what gets spit out in the things. And so folks are going far right and far left. And so that's what people are hearing about. And, you know, as we talked about last time, sort of, centrism is kind of boring. So, yeah, we'll keep seeing where we go.
You know, we did I used to work with the University of Chicago that put out a millennial poll back when millennials were a thing. Now millennials are like 40-something year old homeowners with kids and worried about their taxes. One of the questions was, is America becoming more liberal, or is really the impact that America is becoming more diverse and that the diverse populations of people are also bringing more liberal politics into the mainstream? And so one of the things that I think this group found at University of Chicago was that a lot of white youth weren't really as progressive as their Black and Latino friends, except on a couple of issues, particularly around women and rights for women, and then around rights for LGBTQ. That was something that had clearly moved from, the boomers to the millennials, was a steady progression of rights for women and for LGBTQ Americans.
Yeah, I also think that there is, with younger voters, that they have the ability to hold many more positions than we used to. And I remember, so they can be like in four or five different positions. And in fact, they want to be able to have different positions so they could, from their other friends. And I remember, and this has got to be 10, 15 years ago, I saw Nathan Daschle, the son of Tom Daschle, do a presentation. And basically, he's our age. And he basically said, look, when we grew up, you watch TV, there were three channels, right? There was ABC, NBC, and CBS. And you, whatever that affiliate was, you watched what was on at that time. These younger folks, like the younger millennials and all of Gen Z, they have had on demand their entire existence. They are not going to be put into either binary decisions like, oh, you can either vote Republican or Democrat. Like, they're just not going to accept that. They've always had as much choice as they possibly want. And so I think you're feeling that now in these kind of very diverse policies and kind of political stances. So I think it was very interesting.